And welcome back to Dakota Midday here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Joe Telustis. Tonight on SDPB-TV, a brand new program called Black Hills Metamorphosis. And the show looks at the explosion of pine beetles in the Black Hills and follows up on SDPB's 2010 production, The Black Hills and the Mountain Pine Beetle. We're joined now by the show's producer, Brian Gevick. He's compiled interviews with scientists and forestry experts examining efforts since 2010 to limit damage to the Black Hills forest caused by the insect blight. Brian, always good to see you. Thanks for being on Midday.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
And also joining us in Rapid City is Charles Michael Ray. He took part in interviews, including those of scientists looking at the role of forest management and climate change and how it plays into the issue. Mike, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you, Joe.
Very good. Brian, let's start with you. The epidemic is about 20 years old now, and it has been 20 years in the making. Mm-hmm. Millions of dollars have been spent to try to stop the spread. How many acres in the Black Hills have been impacted so far, and what are the dollar figures?
Well, we're looking at about 450,000 acres. That might not mean very much to a lot of people, but if you consider that the Black Hills forested land is about 1.2 million acres. That's almost a quarter of all the Black Hills land that is forested. Now, it looks like this epidemic peaked in about 2012, and the number of infested acres that they detect every year is dropping off. It has been since 2012. Now, that said, there are still some new infestations coming in, and that's all over the Black Hills, and the bugs are still at the epidemic levels. Now, in terms of the money, but since 2012, which is when they started a concerted and unified effort to plan and strategize, they've spent $55 million. Now, that does not include fiscal 14 spending, which bumps it up to $71 million. Now, that money has gone into forest treatments for both beetles and for fire. And there are a lot of different kinds of treatments. Basically, though, it's been thinning targeted areas. They're removing dead wood where it can be removed. They've sprayed in places. Mount Rushmore, in particular, has had an intensive spraying program. And they've done a lot of work on road and highway right-of-ways, clearing out trees and making those a little bit safer. And some of it also has gone to help support private landowners who have who've had to clear trees.
In putting together a plan that needs coordination, certainly because
right.
of its size. There has been a mountain pine beetle working group. Can you tell us about that group and what have they been working on?
Yeah, the mountain pine beetle working group has been presented to me as the other really big change, or maybe the big change in the hills, is the way that they're started to work. All of these different agencies are working together. And that includes the states of South Dakota and Wyoming, the Forest Service, seven counties in the Black Hills, and the forest products industry has a seat at the table as well. Now, they're saying that they've been able to get more work done, and they've been able to do it also a little bit more economically.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did the original show back in 2010.
Right.
Now this is the update. What's happened? What's going on? And how has it worked?
Well, I think if you look at the four goals that the Mountain Pine Beetle Working Group has laid out, strategies are really complicated, but the goals really are not that hard to understand. The first thing is to do the beetle suppression, to try to tamp down the epidemic. The next thing that they want to do is protect people and communities, and that has a lot to do with what needs to be done with limiting the likelihood of a really bad fire. The third goal is to retain a healthy forest products industry. Now, retain is the word that they use. They're not saying that they're supporting this mm-hmm. forest products industry, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of what forest managers want to do just can't be done without a good, healthy forest products industry in place. And there's a very, very symbiotic relation between the two. And then the fourth goal is to really promote a healthy forest in the Black Hills, and that in terms of the Black Hills means a resilient forest, one where you don't get these, terrible outbreaks that wipe things out. You don't get the terrible fires that might wipe things out. Those things are always going to be there, but the idea is to set up conditions that make those mm-hmm. things less extreme.
Now, you've been on this story for a number of years and have watched it track through, and I'm sure along the way you've run into people.
Sure.
Not only the professionals who are working on making these changes, but the people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your thoughts and observations about maybe contrasting 2010 to 2015 or just general things that may have stayed with you from the people who live in the middle of it?
I think everyone is still very concerned in the general public out there, but there's not the sense of uncertainty. There's not this feeling of, you know, is this whole forest going to go away? I think that they've had a little time to settle in, look at things, understand that things are changing, things are going to be a bit different. Some of this is going to be really expensive. That's been a very difficult thing for a lot of folks to swallow, especially private landowners who have, you know, obviously if you've got a lot of trees and you want to help out and not have your neighbor's property get infested, you've got to spend some money getting them out of there. So there's been that. But a comment that was made to me when I asked about, you know, public perception is that back in 2010, they'd hold these public meetings and you'd fill the town hall, whether it was an educational meeting or something about input. And, you know, 200 or 300 people, they don't get very many people at these meetings anymore. The public's concerned, but they're not, you know, they're not wondering. I don't get the sense that there's this sense of fear. It's more
That's the exact word I was going to ask you about.
It's more like a sense of, okay, where are we at?
Yeah.
You know, they're slogging through it.
Because that's exactly the word I was going to use, because I can remember being out there around that 2010 time, and fear with a capital F was everywhere. But you say that's mitigating now?
Oh, I think so.
They're still concerned,
they've accepted the situation, and they're mainly looking now at several things. Now, you know, there are some things on the horizon. We talked about a healthy forest resilience, and one of the things that's going to be a challenge is regeneration. The pine trees just grow like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anywhere that they've thinned, they're going to have pine trees coming up, and they're going to have to keep doing it. They're going to have to keep after it and after it. So that is a concern for a lot of people. And then, of course, and here's where we bring in Charles Michael Ray.
Yes.
There's a whole issue of climate change.
Let's do that. Let's bring Mike into the conversation here. As we mentioned, forest management is at the heart of the issue. And there is, safe to say, there's not unanimity of agreement on what's what by any stretch. Mike, you talked with scientists who have had opposing views on the best path to go forward. What have you learned in these conversations?
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Joe. And I took part in the interviews in this piece with a couple of scientists, as you mentioned, Dr. John Ball. He's a well-known tree expert from SDSU, and Dr. Diana Six from Montana State University. She's also a well-known beetle and forestry expert who's been widely quoted in the national press, groups like National Geographic. And Dr. Six points out some of the current management practices being used to treat beetle infestations across the Mountain West. She's concerned that these management practices, she says, aren't necessarily backed up by science and they're not necessarily proven. And she says the bugs will blow up into an epidemic only under the right climatic conditions. Tree density plays a part, she says, but without all the factors aligned, we can't get this sort of perfect storm. And she says there's no way to really leave climate change, human caused or not, out of the beetle issue. And we have to start looking at climate change in a new way and creating, managing for forests that can adapt to climate change in the long term. I think we have a soundbite from her we can play.
People are going ahead with management based on past historic variability. They're doing a lot of these thinning and so-called beetle-proofing treatments that are focusing on taking us back to a condition that doesn't occur. My concern is that that may not be good. It may be actually being worse for our forests than doing nothing.
And Dr. Six is researching the idea that some of the trees that survive a beetle attack may have a genetic resistance to drought and beetles. So you have these big stands of trees that are just all dead, but in the middle of them, there can be a certain percentage, 20% maybe, that survive. And she says that these trees need to be looked at carefully because she believes they have a genetic resistance to pine beetles and a genetic resistance to drought. But right now, we don't know the genome of the ponderosa pine. No one's done it. So she says we don't know if we're cutting down trees and thinning operations that may have a genetic ability to resist things like droughts and beetle attack, those kind of trees we want to keep around for the long-term future, the kind of trees that could survive a changing climate. And for this reason, she says we need more scientists, and we need scientists to better connect with forest managers on the ground. She says scientists aren't often invited to the table in groups like the Mountain Pine Beetle Working Group. She says she wants more science in that. Now, on the other side of this coin is Dr. John Ball from SDSU, and he's been a champion of better forest management by thinning. He says this reduces ponderosa pine density in the Black Hills. And Dr. Ball points to several areas in the Black Hills where there is a beetle attack in a stand of dense trees next to a stand of thin trees, like a Custer State Park, for example, next to the Black Elk Wilderness. And he says the thin trees survive much better. And he says this is direct evidence that this kind of treatment works. And Dr. Ball says while climate change may play a role in the big picture of the beetle attack that's happening now across the American West, all the way up into British Columbia, he says in the Black Hills, this little island in the plains, there's no local evidence that can correlate a warmer and drier climate with the current beetle attack. And I think we have a soundbite from him as well.
There has to be a trigger. I can see where climate could be a factor. Density has to be a factor as well. So clearly we have to have a perfect storm, a number of conditions to come in together, because not one of them shows it. We're always going to have beetles. We're always going to have fire. And in fact, the way I say it, as long as we have pines in the Black Hills, we are going to have two other dominant regulators, fire and beetles. It's part of the natural system.
Long term, when it comes to forestry, he says foresters think about what do we want the hills to look like in 2050 or 2100? And on the other side of that coin again, Dr. Six agrees that we need that long-range outlook. But how to best manage the forest to give it the best chance to adapt to that changing climate is still an open debate among scientists and certainly among the public as well.
Does anyone, I'll ask either Mike or I'll ask you, Brian, does anybody give you an estimate on cost going forward? You know, I know that's always a tough question to answer, but what are you know, some of the scale that maybe these guys are talking about as we go forward from 2015, Brian?
Well, I can tell you that for the past several years, they've been spending between $18 and $20 million. That will continue to be necessary as the number of because the number of acres that are likely to be infested, that's still about what it's going to cost to treat those, if I have that correct.
Mm-hmm.
But that'll continue. There'll be fewer acres. I think that really in the long term, the question is what kind of money is going to be dedicated to keeping after the regenerated pine trees, mm-hmm. that are going to fill in these thinned areas.
Mm-hmm. And just to make sure I got it right, when you're talking about the new pine trees, you're talking about thinning for just having more room for the other trees, or is it thinning because there's something special that makes the new pine trees any more susceptible?
I could grab that. Maybe.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
if you drive through Custer State Park and look at the 1988 burn, mm-hmm. that went through Custer State Park in the 80s, that area that burned back then in some places is all these tiny little pine trees, about, you know, as big around as your arm to maybe as big around as your leg, and, you know, between 10 to 12 feet tall. And they're bunched together in what they call dog hair. So they're just right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just imagine when we're in a drought on a 100-degree day and the wind is blowing and someone drops a cigarette in the wrong place or something sparks a fire, that those little trees are going to blow up and burn really hot. And there's concern that after we do all this management, we spend these millions and millions of dollars and we go through and we thin this forest to a beautiful place, pine cones keep dropping. These little trees keep growing up into this dog hair. So we have to continually do things like controlled burns, like thinning, like forest management in order to reduce this potential for these kind of catastrophic wildfires that we could have in the future if we don't keep up with this.
Brian, just asking about, as talking to people going about, is there anything that you heard or saw that really surprised you or stuck with you that you didn't expect to see?
Oh, that's a good question, Joe. I you know, I've been following it for quite a while, and this, there does seem to be a progression here. I think one thing is just that there's a little bit of change in the beetle behavior. Dr. Ball was talking to us about this, and he was saying that, you know, at one time you'd have a bug hit area, a plot, and it would just grow out from that plot. And now it seems like things are kind of jumping around. Mm. The pattern is a little more erratic, that it's not as predictable now as it was 5 years ago. That surprised me, that there's been, mm-hmm. that change in that behavior.
Some details on the show tonight, airtime, and are there any special things you can encourage people to watch for?
Yeah, the show airs at 8 o'clock Central Time, 7 o'clock Mountain, SDPB1. And in terms of what to look for, you know, this really is an effort to go out and try to document what kind of work has been done, what kind of progress there is. And then, as Mike was talking about, to be a little bit forward-looking. So people are going to hear comments, you know, from the officials who have been tracking this thing. They've been in charge of things, and they're really on the record in this show. And, mm-hmm. and so listen for that.
Any airtime tonight?
8 o'clock Central, 7 Mountain.
On SDPB1 TV.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Brian Gavick, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us at midday. Look forward to seeing the show tonight.
Thanks, Joe.
All right. And Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City. As always, Mike, great to get your thoughts and insights on the situation as well, and what is a very important, complicated, and evolving situation.
Thank you so much, Joe.
All right. Thank you. Before we go to break, we're going to welcome in another member of SDPB, our Director of Online Education, Ken Osborne. Kent, welcome to Dakota Midday. And you're here today for another reminder on the very popular Picture South Dakota.
Yes, we're our photo contest, which is in its second year now. And I'm guessing it'll go on for years and years.
It has been popular.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So last year we did a day in South Dakota. This year it's kind of a week in South Dakota. But that week ends tonight at midnight. So your photos taken from October 1st until midnight tonight are eligible to be in the program or in the contest. And we have a web page you're going to want to take a look at. And it's sdpb.org/photo contest. It's very simple. There are some rules there, and you're going to want to take a peek at those. And there's some categories, and you're going to want to spend some time with those as well, because it's a bit of a challenge for folks to categorize what they're shooting and go out and you know, there's pretty good prize money attached to this. Mm-hmm. So to tailor your photographs to the category would be a good thing to do. So they should go out, take a look, get a little research in there. We've got some photos in the gallery now. We're adding more as the day progresses. We've got a little backlog we got to get through, but there's some content to go look at right now. You can go see what other people are doing, and get some inspiration and get out there tonight and get some shots taken.
It's kind of like life. We're all trying to look where we fit in.
Yeah, exactly.
You were talking yesterday. We were talking about the contest, and there were several. School groups, and maybe even groups probably isn't maybe bigger than that. Tell us about
class.
That.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. So we've added sort of a whole second contest this year, and really a category. It's youth, but it's the same categories underneath there. So it's home, connections, South Dakota, you know, are sort of the subsets, but a youth division. So if you're in K-12 or you're under 18, you've got a whole nother chance at a whole nother pot of money. And what we're finding is there's some teachers that this contest resonates with, and they're getting their classes out of the classroom and out taking photos and starting to submit those. And there's some really nice photographs in there, and some really interesting stories coming from the kids.
You've mentioned how the participatory element of this and what it's all about. But it's also, even if a person isn't into doing photography themselves, mm-hmm. It's a great opportunity to go online. There's just so many things to explore and look for.
Yeah. So tomorrow we'll start the People's Choice category. So if you want to be a judge, we have judges that are going to judge this for the prize money, but there is also a People's Choice, both in the youth and the regular Picture South Dakota contest. So you've got an opportunity to vote for your favorite shot. Mm-hmm. That person, again, gets $250.
And will we see some other output after the contest is complete?
That's a great question. You know, I have a feeling there's a couple of photographers we're going to go talk to.
Okay.
Because there are some interesting backstories to these photographs. Mm-hmm. And who knows? Who knows, Joe?
We had a popular calendar last year.
Oh, well, that, yeah. Of course, we'll have the calendar. The Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting will publish a calendar, and that'll go out to the Friends of Public Broadcasting, and assuming it'll be a premium during pledge, I don't know.
I have a funny feeling it may show up somewhere, mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's all a part of this.
Very good. Again, we're running up against the deadline. Mm-hmm. If people want to participate, again, the website's where they should go.
sdpb.org/photocontest.
Photo contest.
Yep.
Very good. Kent, always a pleasure.
Yep.
Looking forward myself to going on and seeing. And again, that People's Choice voting coming up as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So, great. All right. It's called Picture South Dakota. That's Kent Osborne from SDPB. This is Dakota Midday. It's 45 past the hour. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about being a senior. And if we aren't there already, we're getting closer every day. We'll tell you more about that coming up. This is Dakota Midday here on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.